Hello, and welcome to the Small Business University audio series. This series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of teaching small business owners how to run profitable companies. Each presentation features a different national speaker or business owner sharing dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. You probably provide the best products and service in your city. But if you don't collect the money, it's all for naught. If the cash does not come in, you're out of business. Very few people enjoy collecting money. But when you and your office staff are properly trained on how to professionally collect money, the job becomes a whole lot easier. This presentation is by Tim Paulson, the CEO of T.R. Paulson & Associates, located in Toronto, Canada. Now, Tim is a popular speaker and trains companies all over the world on effective ways to collect money. He has over 25 years of practical experience and is the author of two books on collections. Paul has so much to share about collections that it won't all fit in one presentation. This presentation will cover collection standards, collection letters, and will deal with some of the typical excuses that we've all heard before. During part two of this presentation, Paul will deal with the telephone, the obscene collections call, and some very effective negotiating tips. This two-part series will provide some wonderful, fresh material for you to use when it comes to collecting your money. Now let's sit back, relax, and listen to what Paul has to say about collections.
Now, how does anybody get in the business of collections in the first place? I've been through a lot of college and high school yearbooks, and I haven't seen under anybody's picture where it says, you know, I want to be a bill collector when I get out of school. Let me tell you how I got in the business of collections. I was working for a large retail organization in a section of their advertising department, somewhat unglamorous and obscure. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I didn't want to continue doing the same work that I was doing then. They advertised for positions in accounts receivable. They didn't say collectors. They'd found if they advertised for collectors, nobody would apply. Now, I thought I was going to be an accountant, which at the time was a noble profession. I applied for the job, and there was a gal named Phyllis Shire, who was the collection manager, who kind of talked me into it and maybe sold me a bill of goods, gave me a chance to be able to do the job. Brought me in, and I had the advantage of going through their advanced collection training program. Now, what that meant was they brought me in, sat me down next to good old Maisie Tashiro. Now, she'd been in the business for a long period of time. Rumor had it she'd come over on the boat with the founder of the company back in 1847. Maisie was an excellent collector. She wasn't a good trainer. They didn't pay her to train, they paid her to collect. My training program was sit next to Maisie for a day or two. Here's your telephone, here's your accounts, and away you go. Now, you can learn from experience, but it's a pretty hard taskmaster. And sometimes we pick up some of the bad experiences along with the good ones, some of the bad techniques. I recall leaving work one evening. It was a dark and stormy night. Now, it must have been because I was on my way to choir practice, but got confused in the weather, ended up in the Colonial Tavern, which used to be on Yonge Street, just north of Queen. Now, I could have turned around and walked out, but I didn't want to embarrass anybody who worked and toiled hard in that establishment, so I ordered one of their beverages. Now, to make sure they wouldn't be offended, I said, let's make it a double. Got chatting to a fellow sitting next to me at the bar. Turns out he was a sales representative for a computer company. I'm not going to tell you the name of the company, but it has three initials. He asked me where I worked, and I told him I worked at Eaton's across the way. He asked me what I did there, and I hesitated, because I was a bill collector. But I had found if you tell people that you're a collector, there's a certain look that they give you. Someone told me once that collecting money is the second oldest profession in the world, and they added, the least reputable of the two. So I told him that I was a CSR. I was a customer service representative. Well, he asked me what a customer service representative at Eaton's did. Well, I described some of my responsibilities, and he kind of arched an eyebrow, looked at me, and said, it sounds to me like you're a bill collector. And I said, yeah, that's what I do. And then he gave me that look he was probably dying to give somebody anyway. I felt kind of bad about that, but it wasn't too long afterwards. I went to a seminar in Pasadena, California. We spent 3 days covering effective collection techniques, including the standards of professional collections, and I'm going to share those with you, using the acronym of DECK, D-E-C-K. The D stands for dignity, being able to do a job that not that many people understand and few people can do well. Because you mention collections to a lot of people, they get a picture in their mind, it's a large, burly guy. standing on top of a desk, blasting somebody on the other end of the telephone. The collection by decibel theory. Now, it's not to say that's never been used in the business. If it hadn't been, we wouldn't have the reputation that we do. But it's not the techniques I teach, not those that I suggest would be most effective for your firm. Because our business is not so much to collect the money. Our business is to create and maintain a customer. If we don't collect from them, we're not going to have them as a customer anymore. The E in DEC stands for eloquent. You must be eloquent to be a professional collector. You can only collect from someone in one of two ways. You can write to them, or you can talk to them. Now, by being eloquent, I don't mean using large words and phrases that people may not understand. I mean just the opposite. Anything we say, we write. We leave no room for any misunderstanding. And we're going to cover eloquence in a fair amount of detail. The C in DEC stands for competitive. You need to be competitive. When you phone someone up to collect money, there's going to be a lot of competition out there. All the other places they owe, all the other places they could spend money. A few of you out there in consumer collections, I'm sure you've had the experience. You phone someone up, they say, I'd like to pay you, but I just got back from my vacation. The nerve, the gall, the audacity, the temerity, the gumption. Not only to take that vacation with your money, but to tell you about it afterwards and expect you to understand. The K, the last letter in DEC, stands for knowledgeable. We need to be knowledgeable in our business, not only collection techniques, negotiating techniques. You don't need a law degree, but you do need to know the basic legalities involved in collecting in whatever your particular profession, geographical area is. But it doesn't quite end there. A lot of accounts that come across your desk, maybe come up on your computer screen, they're not there because of a lack of money, but there's a dispute. Customer saying something was wrong, something with the product, the service. In theory, if it's corrected, they're going to pay you. Now, too many firms, they say, well, that's a customer service problem. Granted, it may be a different department, individual, has to make an adjustment, has to do something, but the professional collector is going to know exactly what details to take down, who you get them to, how to effectively nag people in your own organization, if that's what it calls for, in order to bring that account back to a current status. As Bert Sutton, one of my collection supervisors, used to say, it's all hands on deck. In this section, I'm going to deal with Zen business writing skills for collections. How many different ways are there to approach someone about a past due account? It really comes down to three. You can knock on the door of their office or their home, and if the balance is high enough, you don't send a letter, you don't make a telephone call, you get on a plane, you fly and visit with your customer. Most of our collection efforts and most of this program will deal with the telephone. This is often the most effective and cost-efficient method for collecting receivables. However, the other approach, and the one that we're going to deal with in this section of the program, is writing. Now, I may use the word letter as I'm talking, but many of the techniques are just as applicable to faxes and to email. Why send a letter at all? Well, perhaps we have difficulty in getting the customer on the telephone. We may want to use a reminder notice, knowing that the squeaky wheel does tend to get the grease. Let them know that we're looking for that payment. Notices and letters may give us the opportunity to contact a lot of customers at a reduced cost. Perhaps we just want to confirm an arrangement made over the telephone. I'll be directing efforts to collection letters, but this is one of the subjects that is applicable to other aspects of your career. One of the other programs I teach is Zen Business Writing Skills, how to do better what we already do well. The same guidelines covered in collections will be effective in other correspondence that you write. Okay, here is your first assignment and where you make the choice of pausing the program. What I'd like you to do is to write a collection letter. Choose any one of your customers that you might be sending a letter out to. You can make up some details as to whether it's the first gosh golly gee whiz letter or maybe one before it goes off to some more serious action. If your mind's coming up a blank, I'll give you a situation. Let's say your Aunt Sally borrowed $500 from you last year. You're supposed to pay her 6 months ago. She hasn't paid, lives out of town. You haven't been able to reach her on the telephone. So take that time now, if you choose, and write that letter. Come back to me when you're finished. Where did we first learn how to write a business letter? For most of us, back in school, could have been high school, perhaps grade school, maybe grade 5, grade 6, when the teacher said, class, today you're going to learn how to write a business letter. Good old Mrs. Thistlebottom. Now, it didn't seem to matter that she'd never written a business letter in her life. She was taught when she was back in grade school, and so on. Think about business writing in general, collection letters in particular. You could have the best written letter in the world. Written by Shakespeare, edited by Francis Bacon, but if people aren't going to read the letter, it wouldn't make any difference. So I say there are no rules involved in writing letters, but I'm going to give you five guidelines. Do with them as you will. And what they are designed to do is to give you better assurance that people are going to read the letters that we send to them. I'll give you the guidelines. I'll come back and explain a little bit about them in just a second or two. First of all, rule number one, or I'm sorry, it's not a rule, it's a guideline, remember. No more than two sentences to a paragraph. Second guideline, no more than 22 words to a sentence. Third, do not start a paragraph with one of these three words, I, we, our. Now, the exception to that, if the we, the our also applies to the reader, you could use it. But if it's about yourself, it's about your company or department, no. Guideline number four, do not use a word of more than three syllables unless it is a technical word that you must use. And the last guideline, number five, no more than one page for the letter. Let me go back and explain a couple of the reasons why. No more than two sentences to a paragraph. There are some business letters I'm sure you've opened up, maybe you've sent a few of them. You take a look and it's just a black sea of words on the page. People are busy. They don't want to read most of the things that we send them, in particular collection letters. One of the things that we write with that you may not have thought too much about is white space. When you have no more than two sentences to a paragraph, you force white space into your letter. It looks and it is easier to read. Second guideline, no more than 22 words to a sentence. A complex idea may require a complex sentence, but that's not what we're going to be writing to people about who owe us money. You want to keep your sentences shorter. Now, W. Somerset Maugham, Jerzy Kaczynski, Tom Robbins, Jacqueline, Suzanne, Stephen King, they can go on for an entire paragraph with one sentence. But they're masters at it. It's fiction writing. It's not the same thing. You want to keep your sentences shorter. Toughest guideline to apply is that third one, not to start off with I, we, our. I is used more than any other word in the English language. We tend to write, think, talk in terms of what's important to us, our departments, our company. No one is going to pay a past due account because it's good for you. They're going to pay when it's good for them. Now, in one letter, it may not make much difference, but you'll send out a lot during your career. The first word of any paragraph tends to stand out more than the other ones do. So this will also force you to think and write in terms of what's important to your customer. Fourth guideline, not to use a word of more than three syllables, and as I had mentioned, unless it's a technical word that you must use. When we are reading, our eyes go from word to word, mentally articulating each word as we go. Come across a big word, our eyes stop, shift, come back. It starts to become work. People are going to start to skip not only the sentence, but then it goes to paragraphs and perhaps even the whole letter itself. Now, this does not mean that you have to sacrifice eloquence because you're not using the big words. Now, I don't think the Lord's Prayer has a word of more than three syllables in it, and I know the soliloquy by Hamlet does not have a word of more than three syllables in it. Gettysburg Address by Abraham Lincoln, one of the finest political speeches ever written. I think it's only 178 words, and a lot of them are two, three syllables at the most. A lot of them won 47 years ago. So you can be eloquent without using the big words. And the last guideline, no more than one page for the letter. If I get a letter of more than one page, I tend to look at the last page, last paragraph, and decide based on that if I'm going to go back and read the rest. Okay, now that we've used the format to get better assurance people are going to read what we've sent them, let's talk about what we're going to put in it, what the content's going to be. For that, I have an acronym of SPRA, S-P-R-A. And what it stands for is Situation, Proposal, Reason, Action. Situation, simple enough, the reason that you're writing to them, there's a past due account, something that hasn't been paid, perhaps a promise that has been broken. Proposal, what you want them to do. Be specific, be eloquent. Reason, why should they? What's in it for them if they do, if they do not? Now, we often find, perhaps in some collection letters, it could be that we threaten other action, we're not going to continue to ship to them, we're going to do something. Now, you could have a customer that you've had for many, many years, you're sending out a letter, and you don't want to put a reason in there. It's fine to leave it out as long as it's a conscious decision on your part and not something that you have forgotten about. Now, the last letter, A, action. Very powerful if you don't overdo it. It's the last thing that they're going to read. Could be a couple of different things. Please, Mr. Smith, your check in the mail today. Please, Elizabeth, when you finish reading this sentence, pick up the telephone, call me at. Give them the number, once again, right there in the body of the letter. Maybe it's up at the top, doesn't matter, give it to them again. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about some eloquence and words and phrases that I suggest that you avoid, not only in what you write, but in what you say. Your vocabulary would improve a great deal if all you did was to drop about 90 to 95% of the words that end with the letters L-Y. L-Y. I think the most useless word in the English language is the word basically. If someone was to ask me what I did for a living and I said, well, basically I travel across North America, sometimes Europe, Asia, and I teach seminars, what I'm saying in the English language is that if the regular speaker does not show up, I'm allowed to read from their notes. Now, most people aren't going to pick that up, but if I just took it out, somebody asked me the question and I responded, I travel across North America, sometimes Europe, Asia, I teach seminars. Think I've lost anything by dropping the word basically? Not a bit. Not only do I not lose anything, it gains by dropping the word. It's what I refer to as a mush word. Basically, your account is 60 days past due. You take it out, you say, your account is 60 days past due. I'll give you a couple of other ones. Actually would be one. Immediately would be another one. If you were to be speaking to me on the telephone and ask me to pay an account immediately, and I agreed and we soon terminated our conversation, what have we agreed to? I would suggest at best two different things. I would think that when you say immediately, what you mean is, Paulson, I expect you to run, not walk, get down here and make this payment by 4 o'clock this afternoon. Now, I'm agreeing to immediately, but I don't see it the same way. Hey, I'm busy. I've got things to do. Maybe the weekend's coming up. Could be a long weekend. I could be talking about Wednesday, Thursday of next week. Now, if you were to say, Mr. Paulson, it's important that your payment reaches us no later than 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at our office. Now, I may not do it, but we know what it is that I have agreed to. Now, the words do not all have to end in L-Y, and they can be more than one word. It could be as soon as possible would be another one. Have a good look through your letter when you have a chance, particularly those of you that have form letters out there, and see if you can find some of these mushy-type words and phrases. Now, I think a good test of a letter is to read it out loud. Would you speak to someone that way? I'm not suggesting that you should be writing word for word as you speak, but a lot closer to it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of our section on Zen Writing for Collections. For those of you that may have taken the time to write one of those letters, or you've got a form letter handy for your firm, take a look at it, see what changes you might be able to make. In this section, we're going to be dealing with the telephone collection call. I'm going to give you an example of a not-so-good collection effort, and yes, there's going to be some questions a little bit later on. Now, you're only going to hear the collector's part of the conversation. You'll be able to use your imagination for the rest. Now, for those of you who are not driving, you may just want to close your eyes and listen to this. Hello? I'll bet you don't know who this is. No. No. No, it's Tim. No, Tim Paulson. No, we've never spoken before. I'm just calling from Nordic Frabistad. It's about this outstanding account that you have with us, and I wonder if you might be able to look after it for me. Well, the boss is on vacation. Wow, geez, I guess there's really not much point in my talking to you then. Well, what do you think the best thing's for me to do? Maybe give you a call sometime next week? Next month? Yeah, okay, well, that's what I'll do then. I'll give you a call sometime next month. Sorry to bother you. Bye-bye. Now, a bit of an exaggeration, sure it was, but I've heard professional collectors make each and every one of the mistakes that I made in that collection call, except for the beginning one. I bet you don't know who this is. I just threw that in there just for fun. If you said everything was wrong with the call, you wouldn't be too far wrong, but I suggest in a collection call you can make one of two mistakes, a mistake of commission, something that you say that you should not have, or a mistake of omission where you leave something out. Now, here's a chance for you to be specific, stop the program, and write out your list of the mistakes that were made in that telephone collection call. Okay, let's see how your list may compare to mine. First of all, identification of the customer, the debtor. Don't want to have to guess whether you've got the right person on the phone or not. Now, in consumer collections, you want to make sure you have the person on the phone that owes you the money. Commercial collections, it's the person who has authority to pay you, or perhaps the person who can provide you with information as to the status of the account. The collector didn't identify himself at the beginning of the conversation. We don't want to get into a guessing game with the customer, so identify self and company. There are a couple of different ways to do that, which I'll talk to you about in a minute or two. The collector was not assertive, apologized even almost for making the call. Now, there can be times to offer an apology, but I don't apologize for someone for making a call when they owe my company some money. The collector wasn't prepared. We could talk about follow-up. It went from sometime next week to sometime next month. Details of excuse. The boss had been away on vacation for a while. There's a lot of information we may want to know. Now, you may have a few others on your list, but I wonder if you have this one that's missed by many of the collectors, even some of the seasoned veterans in the seminars that I teach. The collector did not ask for the money. asking someone if they will take care of an account is not the same as a direct request for payment. You may recall the film Jerry Maguire, Show Me the Money. Paulson's rule number one, ask for the money. Now, how you do it, when you do it, you've got a couple of options to it, but please make sure that you do. The telephone is one of the most important tools that you have at your disposal, second only, perhaps, behind your own imagination. There are three phases to a professional collection call: statement, response, rebuttal. Now, if you master them, you're going to find yourself more successful in managing your receivables. Phase number one, identification. Make sure you got the right person on the phone, identification of self and company. Make a statement. Could be something along the lines of the following. Mr. Sutton, my name is Tim Paulson. I'm calling from Nordic Frabisat. It's concerning your outstanding account with us. There's a balance due and payable today of $348.19. Will you mail me a check today, please, for $348.19? It's specific, it's eloquent, and it doesn't need to be too aggressive. It does need to be assertive. Phase number two is where we're going to get a response from the customer, what they say to us. Now, this is where an opportunity for you to listen hard, avoid distractions, take some notes. The customer is going to say one of two things. Sometimes they're going to say yes. It doesn't happen too often, but it does happen in collections where someone says, well, sure, I forgot about it, whichever, and I'll send you that check today for the $348.19. And when that happens, we almost want to go, whew, that wasn't too bad. Maybe get on with the next call. I suggest most times you want to go a lot further. Mr. Sutton, I appreciate you're going to get that check off to me in the mail, and I'll take some details down in just a moment or two. But perhaps while I have you on the phone, I wonder if you could explain to me why the account got to such a past due status. Is there anything we should know about? Now, this sort of a question is not going to elicit unbridled enthusiasm on the part of the people that you're talking to. And it's not meant to. You're asking them for two reasons. Number one, they may not do what they said they were going to do. Maybe you, one of your associates, has to speak to them again next week, the week after. They give you a different excuse. Now, we're not playing a game. We don't want to come back and say, gotcha. But you may want to come back and say, Mrs. Smith, I don't quite understand. Spoke to you last week and you had mentioned the check had been left in the briefcase at your office. You were going to mail it the next day. And now you're telling me something completely different. I can't work with you on this account unless I know the real reason for non-payment. The other reason that you ask them, even if they do what they said they were going to do, I suggest that a collection call from you and your company should not be a total pleasant experience. Now, what I mean by that, if a individual, a company's having a difficult time, I'm going to bend over backwards and work with them as best as I can to keep them as a customer. But other than that, I expect them to pay their bills. And if they don't, I'm going to ask them some questions, some things they may not care for. It could aggravate them a little bit, still in a professional manner, because I want them to think twice next time they're going to be getting my statements, my invoices in the mail. Often, of course, within phase two, they're going to give us an excuse, some reason as to why they can't pay in full today. Two types of excuses that we're going to hear, the usual excuse and the rare excuse. And we're going to deal with both of those in phase three of the collection call. And this is the phase that pays and what most of the balance of this program is going to be about. First thing I'm going to be dealing with are those usual excuses that we hear. In your business, regardless of your product or your service, I suggest there are about 9, perhaps 10 excuses you hear 95% of the time. You've heard them before, you know you're going to hear them again. Here's a list of some of the usual excuses for both consumer and commercial collections. Out of work. Waiting for money. My customers owe me, and when they pay me, I'm going to pay you. The sales are down. Bookkeeper is off sick. I've been on vacation. I'm going on vacation. The boss is away on vacation. The check needs a second signature. This one always gets me because they always have one signature, but they need a second signature. Somebody's ill. Could be the customer. Could be the person that signs the checks. Could be accounts receivable. They need POD, proof of delivery. Need a copy of the statement. Customer service issue. Something wrong with the product, with the service. And of course, there's the old standby, we hear it so often, the check is in the mail. Now, you don't have to be in the business too long before somebody's going to tell you that the check is in the mail. Now, you may know the information you should obtain on most occasions, and here's a chance for another pause in the program. Take the excuses, check in the mail, and write down the information that you believe you might need. Okay, got your list of questions. Let's see how they compare to mine. When was the check mailed? Who mailed the check? What address did you send it to? How much was the check for? Check number, date on the check. Bank that it was drawn on, check number. You'll find that most of these questions are based around the five W's: who, what, where, when, and why. But have you ever had the experience of handling one of those typical excuses and you hang up the telephone, disconnect the call, and you remember, you know, I should have asked him something else? Now, it's not difficult to miss some of these questions. Collections can be a tough business. We're thinking of what they just said, what we're going to say next. There can be distractions in the office. It's easy enough to miss a question or two. Minor they may be. By themselves, they may not be that important. It may not be worthwhile when we've got other customers to deal with to call that particular customer back. Now, this is an audio program, so you can't see what I'm holding in my hand, but allow me to describe it for you. It or something like it is one of the best tools that you can have available when you're dealing with delinquent customers. We call it the Professional Collector's Flip Tray. It's 3x5 cards. There are 25 of them. And you can see the titles of the cards down at the bottom. And here we have the 9 to 10 excuses that you hear 95% of the time in the business. We've got sets of trays for commercial and sets for consumers. So when somebody tells you the check is in the mail, you've got your tray beside you, you flip the check is in the mail, and it has all those questions down there that you want to ask most of the time. Now, it's not a script for collectors, because I found that most of us don't care for scripts all that much, but it's something that can just jog your memory, let you know some of the questions that you want to ask. From my website, if you look under products, you'll be able to find out more information about this tray, and you'll be able to see a picture of it. Now, my company sells them, and it's always nice to sell, but my objective is not to get you to buy one of the trays. My objective is to have you deal with the typical excuses in a fashion so that you're never going to miss the important questions again. So here's what I suggest you do. Number one, list down all the typical excuses that you hear in your business. Two, take the time to develop your questions. Use the five W's. Maybe one or two of them is not applicable, but it's a good place to start. Three, put the information into a format that will sit handily on your desk within easy reach. Add to it. You're going to find that there's some excuses you're going to hear at different times of the year. And the last thing, you're going to find other uses for the tray or whatever format you develop. Sources of money could be an example. List down reminders of phases of a call. And write down, ask for the money. Now, the flip tray or some product like that is fine and a wonderful tool for dealing with those usual excuses you hear. But one of the benefits of being in collections, there you sit some sunny Thursday afternoon, you call someone up, and they give you an excuse that you have never heard before. Now, I know what we're like in collectors. If I hear an excuse I haven't heard before, I'll tell you, I can't keep it to myself. I got to go down and find somebody. I got to say, Bert, you wouldn't believe what this person just told me on the phone. And if Bert's been in the business for a period of time, I guarantee you he's not going to say, Tim, I think that's the most interesting excuse I've ever heard. Bert's going to say something like, ah, that's nothing. Let me tell you what somebody told me last week. Carol comes walking past us, and she joins in. She's got a better one than that. And away we go sharing some C stories. Now, a lot of companies I go into, we have a contest once a month for the collector that hears the most unusual excuse. And as a result, we manage to increase productivity a little bit because people aren't talking about them quite so much. So for that unusual excuses, I can share a few of them with you. One company I was at, we had two people on the same day in different parts of the country claim their bank had burned down. And they hadn't. One fellow we talked to said his cat died 3 months ago. And he loved that cat. It wasn't just our bill. He was in mourning. He wasn't paying anybody. A gentleman out in British Columbia said his friend had been bitten by a rattlesnake when he was up in the mountains of B.C. It went through a long, involved sea story. There was a goat eating a walnut. It just went on and on and on. And one woman that one of our collectors phoned up, she said, if you keep phoning me to collect this account, I'm going to file a paternity suit against your company. That's right, paternity suit. And she explained. She said she had recently started taking birth control pills, and they were affecting her metabolism a little bit, and our calls were making things worse. She said one of the two is going to have to stop. So if we kept phoning her, she'd stop taking the pill, and if she got pregnant, paternity suit against the company. Now, what the heck are you going to do with an excuse like that? So any of you that have had a chance to look at that flip tray of mine, paternity suit against the company was not one of our standard excuses. Now, you could have a flip tray of 350, 400, 500 cards. You're never going to cover everything. You're always going to hear something different. What can you do? I suggest two things. First of all, if the person is going to be difficult to get a hold of, you finally got past their voicemail, you finally got past Brunhilde, who's the secretary that's been covering for them at the office, you finally get them on the phone, they give you an unusual excuse, you're going to have to wing it. Sometimes you have to fly by the seat of your pants pocketbook. But this is where you can have a little card. Now, some collectors have a piece of paper up by their office that have those five W's on them. Who, what, where, when, and why. A quick glance at that, maybe a deep breath, and into the breach you go once again. And if you should terminate the conversation, it occurs to you you should have asked him something else, the balance is high enough, call him back. Mrs. Smith, this is Tim Paulson calling back again. I know we spoke a couple of minutes ago, but there were one or two questions I should have asked, and if I may, I'll ask them now. And just go ahead and do it. There's another technique that you can use, very effective when the person's not that difficult to get a hold of. You can say something like the following. Mrs. Trombley, I've never heard anybody use an excuse like that for not paying their account, and I'm not sure how to deal with it quickly, and I don't want to waste your time or mine. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to hang up the telephone, and I'll call you back in 5 minutes. Now, you can see why you wouldn't use this technique with someone who's been difficult to get a hold of, but for other folks, it can work quite effectively. Maybe you don't call back in 5, you call back in 30 minutes, you call back the next day. But somewhere during that time, you get yourself a piece of paper, a card, and write down the questions that you want to ask them, maybe some statements that you're going to use. Now, when you call them back, two things are going to happen. Number one, you are ready for them. A positive attitude by itself doesn't get you anywhere. It's what you do with that positive attitude. And number two, they know that you're ready for them, that you're not going to be put off by an excuse they may have used in the past just to get a collector off the telephone. And that's just about to lead us into the next section of our program where we're going to be dealing with the obscene telephone collection call.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each presentation. Please feel free to give us a call with your comments. The Small Business University audio series is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, please give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963, or check out our website at www.grandyassociates.com. Until next time, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.